Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. I got my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski, Jr.
Woo-woo.
And we got another special guest today, Dr. Matthew Negra. He is a naturopathic doctor, which we were just talking about on the podcast before. He's a unicorn naturopathic doctor, though. He is legit evidence-based. And he's going to be talking with us today about the recent WHO's recommendations about non-nutritive sweeteners, including our favorite diet sodas. So welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Obviously, we've interacted a bit in we have a Twitter chat there, but good to finally kind of meet face to face.
Yeah, I'd love to hear your just real quick about the whole naturopathic thing, because we've had podcasts before, not blasting the profession of the NDs, but like more of specific NDs in the past who have just and obviously MDs and DOs.
To be fair.
MDs and DOs who just do the same thing.
Plenty of medical doctors are quacks, and you know, there are chiropractors who are quacks, and then chiropractors who really stick to their what they do right and do great stuff. And so, yeah, I'm really interested in this as well.
Yeah, because you know some of this information way better than any, you know, MD, DOs. So it's interesting. It's great to see your stuff online too. So yeah.
And the potential to have a naturopathic physician who really sticks with that mantra and only sticks to the evidence could be really beneficial for people instead of people getting sucked into these, you know, rabbit holes. So,
yeah, no, thanks. That definitely means a lot. You know, when I guess first came into this profession or wanted to, it's like almost a decade ago now, as I was starting to move this direction, I did buy into a lot more of the nonsense, what we'll say. And I understand that there's a lot of that in the profession. I don't shy away from that. But within the scope of practice, I mean, we have nutrition, clinical nutrition. We have pharmaceuticals. We can prescribe. I do prescribe. You know, that's kind of a misconception. I was involved with the COVID immunization campaign out here in Vancouver for like a year and a half up until they didn't need us anymore, you know, 5 months ago or whenever that was. So, you know, we have that within our scope, and it's sort of up to the individual, like, where do they go with their practice? Do they focus more on this stuff, or do they focus more on the, you know, botanicals, herbal stuff, you know, whatever, Chinese medicine, et cetera. And there's definitely a group of us that want some change in certain ways as well. And certainly a lot of us who were in the COVID campaign, we, you know, chatted a lot about these sorts of things. But yeah, like you said, I mean, there's that in every profession. Some professions have more of it than others. And I'm glad that at least to you guys, I'm sticking out a bit on that, which is good to hear.
Yeah. Here's a question I have for you, because you mentioned, so you're in Canada.
Yeah.
Is there, because I often hear of significant differences in licensure and practice habits of all different like professionals. I mean, even medical physicians of in Canada versus here in the United States. Is there anything like that with you guys?
So for your profession, I'm not sure. For us, yes, it varies a lot, even within the country. So like from here to, if we look at Ontario, one of the other, I'd say, provinces with the most number of NDs, they actually have very limited prescribing rights. For prescriptions, they can do like high dose vitamin D or like a few things like that. But like over here, we can prescribe almost anything. There are some limits on certain things, but like we can't prescribe testosterone, we can't prescribe certain, you know, potentially narcotic medications, but otherwise, like, you know, statins, GLP-1s, like all that stuff we can prescribe. And so we have a lot more access in that way, and things are actually expanding. We just got rights to do iron infusions as well, if needed. So it does vary a lot. I would say though, in parts of the States, especially in Washington State, because I'm more familiar with it because it's close to me, they're very much on par with MDs there in a lot of ways. They can even send patients direct to specialists, which I can't do. I would have to communicate with a patient's family doctor in order to do that.
What's the percentage of naturopathic doctors prescribing statins?
I couldn't tell you that. I would say the majority of us have prescribing rights. if not for anything else than like the educational purposes. Like your patients are going to come in on medications. You better know what they're doing and what they mean and what interacts with those. As far as how many are prescribing statins, I don't know. I'm actually speaking with our provincial association to give a lecture on lipids and lipid lowering therapy at our next annual conference.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, hopefully that happens. I've definitely thrown the idea out there. But I would say I'm one of the statin shills of the profession. So
that's amazing.
So,
very good.
And actually, one thing I will mention, I think is worth mentioning based on what Carl said, is I get a lot of patients because of the profession I'm in coming to see me because they want to, you know, avoid medications and that sort of thing. That happens all the time. And I'm happy to meet patients where they're at and discuss like, look, this is where your risk is. Let's say elevated LDL or ApoB. This is where your risk is. You know, we might be able to do X amount with nutrition and we can see how far that goes, but you may end up needing a medication to drop it down to ideal levels. And we have that discussion. And I would say in most cases, even though they've already told their doctor, no, I'm not doing medications, I end up getting them on it. Just because they, I guess that extra trust and the willingness to try the nutrition side first. And so I do think there are positives to having people like me in this profession as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. Great. I feel like that's, you're kind of like that with them as I feel like we've always tried to be. You know, we try to be as, you know, fluid and open to all the data away from, you know, pharma schools, of course. I mean, I think everyone should be, but that's cool. I feel like, yeah, we kind of meet in the middle a little bit.
Very cool. So let's dive into the WHO thing because it caused quite an uproar a week ago or maybe a week and a half ago.
Yeah.
And so let's go into like, what were the recommendations? What was the thing? They actually published it a year ago and they finally just kind of reported on it, right?
Well, was it actually published or was it the proposals put out there and then finalized and published now?
So the review, the review meta-analysis was published, I think close to a year, maybe 6 months ago. So that was published. Mm-hmm. The guidelines, sort of the, their takeaways or recommendations from that just came out.
Yeah.
So,
right. Okay.
So that, you know, came after the fact. And so I'll just read verbatim what the recommendation was. So
I'd be actually, so because what's amazing is that, so people might think of us as almost like non-nutritive sweetener shills. But that's because of the evidence. I mean, back in 2021, I wrote a counterpoint based on all the evidence about using them in place of sugary sweetened things for weight loss. And ever since then, more meta-analyses came out basically supporting that. And the irony, and maybe you can speak to this at least in a one-liner, is that, as you noted, when the WHO's meta-analysis systematic review came out last year, it seemed to support our recommendations, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, I looked at it again just this morning.
That was my takeaway as well. And it's, but I can see how you can read it either way. Like, it's not very clear in that sense. And obviously, we'll get to that. But yeah, so the recommendation verbatim, this is what it says. The WHO suggests that non-sugar sweeteners not be used as a means of achieving weight control or reducing the risk of non-communicable diseases. And then in parentheses, they have conditional recommendation. So there's a few things to consider. There's for one, like what's that based on? What exactly are they saying? And they do elaborate on this. And then two is like, what does a conditional recommendation mean? So let's actually start with that one. A strong recommendation are the recommendations for which the WHO guideline development group is confident that the desirable consequences of implementing the recommendation outweigh the undesirable ones. So that would be a strong recommendation. That's something that can be implemented in a policy or adopted in the policy. A conditional recommendation, which is what this is, are the recommendations for which the WHO guideline development group is less certain that the desirable consequences of implementing the recommendation outweigh the undesirable consequences, or when the anticipated net benefits are very small. And then they go on to say that, you know, this is something that warrants further discussion before being adopted into policy. So we have to also keep in mind, you know, people are running with this headline, like WHO says artificial sweeteners are terrible for you. They're going to kill you. They're making pretty clear that this is, they aren't like 100% certain on this. This is something that needs further discussion.
And in fact, they're not saying to avoid them. That's the thing. The headlines always, and we knew this was going to happen the second it went out. The headline always says something. That's not at all what the document says.
But the actual WHO news site, their like press release site, did say that though. That's what was so confusing about it.
It said what? What did it say?
The actual WHO's news site, their press release site, their headline was something recommends against non-nutritive sweeteners. And then they had the one of the whoever is the author or whatever they went in and kind of gave a few little tidbits about why they're making this recommendation. But what you're saying exactly is it's more uncertain. We don't really know. It's a little bit more vague in their official.
It's more cautious. Yeah.
And the other thing, and I don't know, I tried to look for this, but in a lot of other clinical practice guidelines in medicine, for example, I know this because of the Endocrine Society guidelines, the terms used for the recommendation also correlate to sort of that confidence level like you were talking about with the conditional. And so when they use terms like suggest, that's also a very weak term as opposed to recommend or strongly recommend. And so I noted that right away. And it's still, while I would, you know, I would still argue that the data that they even provided really show that these are still better than sugary sweetened options. I don't know. Well, I still think it should have said suggested. I think it should have said the opposite. We suggest using these in place of sugar sweetened beverages. But the problem is we don't have a lot of long-term trials. And that was one of their limitations that they noted.
But also, I think they're just saying just drinking them in general. Like you have to replace a sugar, like you have to replace the calories.
Yeah,
but if you're just going to drink them to try to lose weight just by themselves, that's not going to do anything. So they have to be specific about that.
Yeah, it's very semantic because if you go through their review, their systematic review and meta-analysis, they show. When they put a little circle around the studies and say these were versus sugary sweetened beverages, it's like, yeah, that's the whole point.
Yeah, and I just pulled up the news report that they sent out, the media, I guess, paper for it, and it says WHO advises not to use non-sugar sweeteners for weight control in newly released guideline. So specifically for weight control, they're saying not to use them.
Yeah, that kind of goes to like what you're saying, Spencer. Like, yeah, nobody should drink diet beverages in hopes to lose weight. It's if you are replacing sugar sweetened beverages. And that's actually, you know, as I'm thinking about this, I go back to that thing I wrote in 2021. It was very specifically to replace sugar sweetened beverages. I mean, I knew that was the key concept. So I was careful to, you know, make that semantically in line.
Yeah. You know, some of the rationale behind that, at least as far as they noted, is that when they assessed in this review from a year ago or 6 months ago that we'll talk about, that high consumption versus low consumption did not, you know, provide evidence of, or at least observational research on high versus low consumption did not provide evidence of long-term benefits for body mass or body fatness. And there were potential risks as far as type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, mortality, and of course, we'll talk more about that as well. And they also made very clear that these recommendations do not apply to people with diabetes because they actually excluded studies on people with diabetes. So that's another thing to kind of take home.
Where the benefits are actually a little bit more clear. And I guarantee that people out there in the headlines aren't paying attention to that because that's pretty definitive.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so as well. Do you want to get into the review at this point and like some of the things that came up there?
Because I think it's important. You talked about, they mentioned the potential long-term risks. Those are all based on those observational cohorts where the correlation doesn't equal causation. So I think it's important to talk about what the review is about. we can't say that it does, but they're saying maybe.
We don't think there's biological plausibility, but I don't know, maybe.
But that's their hesitancy, and that's why they had this like very weak, vague, and don't use them recommendation.
Yeah, and I would say like I'm a staunch defender of observational research in most cases, but I think there are real issues with the observational research on this topic specifically.
Yeah, let's get into it.
And so now I sent you this image sensor as soon as it came out from the review, and I know you posted it on Instagram, but it's a side by side of the results from the observational research and the results from the randomized controlled trials. So in the observational research, they noted that, and this is for high consumption versus low consumption. Obviously, that can mean different things on the population, you know, what is considered high or low. There was an increased risk of incident obesity, higher BMI, increased risk of type 2 diabetes, fasting glucose, cardiovascular events and mortality, bladder cancer, specifically for saccharin, which I don't think is even used very much, and then a higher risk of preterm birth as well when consumed during pregnancy. Now, if you go over to the randomized controlled trials, we actually see that when replacing sugar, there's a reduction in body weight and BMI. And unsurprisingly, that's probably due to the reduction of total calorie intake, which on average was 569 calories a day, which is a lot for what is probably a pretty simple, probably a pretty simple swap. And then that's 38 grams of sugar as well, lower intake. Yeah. So, you know, how is it that in these RCTs, when you're replacing sugar, you're dropping caloric intake, you're dropping weight, but then in the observational research, we're seeing an increase in, you know, insulin obesity. So it's, you know, on the one hand, is it the case, and I don't see why this is plausible, but, you know, where these trials are typically 6 months or less, where you get this reduction in weight, and then all of a sudden the artificial sweeteners go the other way and, you know, increase weight down the road when you're looking at 10-year follow-up or something. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but, you know, that's, I guess, one possible explanation. Another thing is there are potential issues with the observational research. Like, well, are they considering how much, for starters? Are they considering what you're replacing? Are they looking at replacing water or perhaps tea or coffee, which are health promoting, or are they replacing sugar sweetened beverages? And then is there issues with like confounding or reverse causality where people who are maybe struggling to manage their body weight or struggling to manage their blood glucose levels are then switching to artificial sweeteners? So they're already kind of up against it moving forward. And then you follow them for the next, you know, 5, 10, 20 years. And they, of course, have a higher risk, but not because of the artificial sweeteners. If anything, that was an attempt to control those risk factors. I mean, there's all of these issues that can play into it. And unfortunately, this review or these observational studies that they used didn't really consider that, which is unfortunate. But we do have research that actually does. Like for starters, there was a meta-analysis published in 2021. And when you look at, in that one, they looked at all-cause mortality, cardiovascular disease mortality, and cancer mortality. And for sugar-sweetened beverages, it was basically linear. The more you consume, the higher your risk of those outcomes got. But with the artificially sweetened beverages, it was pretty much neutral as far as risk up until a serving a day. And then after a serving a day, risk went up. So maybe, and this would be just speculative, I don't quite fall into this camp, but you could speculate that, hey, maybe at a certain level of intake beyond that serving a day, risk goes up. I think that's a fair speculation based on that data. But then we also have to get into, you know, some of the other issues that we're talking about. So before we get into like reverse causality and replacement, any like comments on that or any questions about that stuff?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, you talk about what are the potential, you know, mechanisms. I think people are always concerned about the gut microbiome. Does that somehow play a role in, you know, some metabolism or some different compensation? You know, we talk a lot about the energy balance system and increased appetite and et cetera. And, you know, it's one of the reasons we all tell people, hey, if you think that the diet beverages cause you to get hungrier and overcompensate later, well, then that's a problem. And so we acknowledge that that's at least been looked into as a possible cause, but it's certainly not across
the board. Yeah, and they've studied that before, and they show that's not the case.
And it's like, right.
Yeah, so, and like some of the trials that look at this stuff, like they're using pretty high doses too. That's the other thing. That's one of the reasons I don't think that even at those like 2, 2.5, 3 servings a day, it's going to be a problem just because like we have trials on that sort of dose.
You did mention saccharin. You didn't think people use it. I drink the shit out of saccharin.
With your coffee and your hotels.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm at a hotel coffee, I drink the shit out of saccharin. And it's also on the Pour Some Sugar on Me song. Right?
What?
Don't they say saccharin?
It is. So, I should know,
you know
that.
So,
one of my
so I think fans. I think that supports the use of saccharin for the benefits, in my opinion.
Yeah, there you go. Def
Leppard.
Yeah, side story. I know Phil Collin, the guitarist from Def Leppard, very well. I'm actually seeing him in a few weeks. Wow. So I'm gonna bring this up to him. Maybe he'll listen to the podcast.
Please tell him to follow us and share.
Yeah. He's a fellow vegan, by the way. I'm gonna just shout that out because I am as well. Anyways, so we've kind of talked about the dose and maybe possible mechanisms, although I don't think it's super convincing. I don't think any of us think they're super convincing. The other thing to consider, though, is like I said, what if people who are already kind of on the road to developing some of these illnesses are more likely to consume those beverages? And I think some research that points to that are the Nurses' Health Study and Health Professionals Follow-Up Study. And so these are some of the best nutrition cohorts we have out there. They you know, take their diet, lifestyle, and health data every 2 to 4 years, and they have been for decades at this point. So you have good follow-up. You know if they're changing stuff along the way. And they're health professionals. So presumably, when it comes to filling out these sort of health questionnaires, they might be pretty good at it or better at it than the general population. And you know, at baseline, so there was an association between artificially sweetened beverages and mortality. But something to note is that at baseline, higher intakes were associated with greater BMI to start and hypertension. Now they do adjust for those variables, which is great, but it might be tough to fully rule out some of those health concerns contributing to risk, because like, what if it's the case that for something like hypertension, or even for something like, you know, diabetes or whatever, where it's a cutoff of yes and no, you have diabetes, you don't, or you have high blood pressure, you don't. Mm-hmm. What if it's the case that people with artificially sweetened beverages are riding the line of normal, mm-hmm. but towards the high? And then what if it's the case that amongst the people with high blood pressure, those consuming the artificially sweetened beverages have much higher, say, blood pressure, blood sugar, et cetera, than people who weren't? It could skew the results a little mm-hmm. bit, even after adjustment.
Yeah, all those people that you just mentioned, they do have all those increased risks, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, people with obesity, prediabetes, metabolic syndrome, hypertension, they all have increased risks of each other and the actual outcomes we care about.
Yeah, exactly. And then, so one thing that they did, and one way to try to control for that issue of switching to artificially sweetened beverages to mitigate risk, is that you do a lagged analysis. So they did an 8-year lagged analysis where you look at your intake now compared to your outcome 8 years plus down the road. And when they did that, because that removes the chance that you develop something really quickly, which is probably due to something you did before. When they did that, the results were largely attenuated. There's still a little bit of risk, but it came down quite a bit. And so that suggests that, yeah, that sort of reverse causality type thing might have been playing a role.
Mm-hmm.
But in my opinion, the best study that talks to both that point and to the issue of what you're replacing it with is a meta-analysis published in 2022. Now, the reason this is so good is they only included studies that adjusted for initial adiposity. So whatever their measure of adiposity was at baseline, whether that's BMI, waist circumference, et cetera. And so you know that you're starting hopefully on a pretty level playing field. And then second, they only included studies that performed repeated measures of beverage intake. So you know if they're changing, you know, increasing or decreasing over time, and or substitution models. So you know if they're substituting mm-hmm. like water or sugar sweetened beverages for the artificially sweetened beverages. And when they did that, oh, and I should mention most studies were 10 to 26 years long, so pretty good follow-up as well. And when they did that in the change analysis, so this is looking at changes in intake over time, increasing artificially sweetened beverage intake by one serving per day was associated with a lower body weight and waist circumference with no significant effect on type 2 diabetes risk. So we're seeing positives there, no negative.
Yeah, that's good.
And then in the substitution analysis, swapping a serving of artificially sweetened beverages for sugar sweetened beverages, and I realize that can be kind of confusing. So consuming artificially sweetened beverages instead of mm-hmm. sugar sweetened beverages, a serving, was associated with lower body weight, lower obesity incidence, lower coronary heart disease incidence, lower cardiovascular mortality, and lower total mortality.
Yeah.
So that's huge.
Yeah.
And those, and what you're talking about, those aren't even, that analysis wasn't even based on
No, those are
interventional trials. Those are prospective observational cohorts. They just analyzed it correctly, right?
Yeah, and they're kind of modeling it after an RCT by doing mm-hmm. the substitution as well, right? You're kind of comparing it to one specific thing, and you know, you're considering baseline adiposity and whatnot. And then now they also looked at swapping water. So if you were to consume water instead mm-hmm. of sugar sweetened beverages, again, lower body weight, waist circumference, body fat percentage, obesity incidence, and type 2 diabetes risk. So more positives, whether you're swapping sugar sweetened beverages for the, you know, diet soda or for water. But I think the most interesting findings are when you're swapping artificially sweetened beverages for water.
Yeah.
In this case, there were no significant findings for body weight, obesity incidence, type 2 diabetes incidence, or stroke incidence. Those are the only outcomes they looked at for that. It's probably the only ones that they had sufficient data mm-hmm. on. But we're not even seeing significant risk when replacing water with artificially sweetened beverages.
Well, but did they measure their microbiome, though? I'm just kidding.
Remember several years back, so Spencer and I used to do this lifestyle medicine blog for MedPage Today, and I think it's been a while now, but in 2015, there was actually one of those trials that we're talking about has been meta-analyzed, actually you know, did the replace sugar sweetened beverages with diet drinks and water. And in at least one trial that at least one meta-analysis used, it looked like the non-nutritive sweetened, artificially sweetened beverages did even better than water in the relatively short-term trial, which of course people freaked out about, but you know, don't shoot the messenger.
Yeah. I mean, the hypothesis is that maybe if you're craving things, this actually gives you some sort of relief.
Which I actually personally, and this is where I think personalization comes into play. I think it does help me. I mean, I really do. We joke around about it, but I really do enjoy my diet pops, you know? And it does kind of give me that little something extra without getting more.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's a big point too, is like some people, as far as appetite or cravings and whatnot, they might respond differently That's fine. Right. Like these are based on like averages in the population, you know, in these particular studies. And so you have to always consider that too. But by and large, I don't see any good reason to be concerned about consuming them. At least at this point. I mean, maybe more data will come out down the road that suggests otherwise and open to changing my view. But I mean, I think we have pretty good data at this point. Suggesting that they're pretty safe.
Here's a question. Why do you think the WHO, like, why did they go with the way that they said this? And do you think they should have just worded it differently?
See, I don't know, because it all comes back to that review they published last year or whenever that was. And I don't know why they didn't, at least in their like final, you know, presentation of the results, why they didn't emphasize the importance of substitution and now they do mention in there that, like, to be clear, they do mention the potential for reverse causality and whatnot as well. They do. And so kudos to them for that. But I just don't know why they didn't consider especially the replacement aspect. Yeah. I think that's so huge. That's nutrition. That is nutrition.
Yeah, right.
You know, no matter what you're looking at in nutrition research, you're replacing something with something else.
One thing I know I've heard, you know, about a lot of the criticism of the World Health Organization, a lot of it comes from, you know, people here in the United States or maybe Canada, is that they really have to consider a lot of global aspects. And, you know, I don't know how that necessarily influences this specific recommendation, but I know that's the case for a lot of their recommendations that often get criticized. So, you know, to be fair, I mean, it's not like we're going after them. We're just concerned that this is misconstrued and going to cause more problems. But maybe that, I don't know. Can you guys think of any reason why on a global scale that is there, you know, some place, you know, third world countries where, I don't know, somehow this is going to cause problems? Like if they didn't make it that recommendation, I don't know.
I have no idea.
Yeah, I really don't know. I mean, also in fairness, I guess, just based on, I think they might have used GRADE. I can't remember what criteria they use for like the certainty of evidence too. But like for pretty much all the findings, it was like very low to low as well throughout the review. Like so perhaps that's leading into the whole conditional recommendation thing. And there is lack of certainty. At least they're very transparent about that. But I don't know why they're leaning so far that way. At least based on my takeaway of their comments. That doesn't make a lot of sense.
Okay, so just a quick synopsis. Basically, because all I said is that, like, hey, don't drink these things to try to lose weight unless you're replacing sugar-sweetened beverages. If you're going to go from a Coke to a Diet Coke, probably a good thing. You can go to water if you want to. That's the gist. We're not telling people to go ahead and drink these things as, like, fat burners or something like that. It reminds me of the studies where they told people, hey, go ahead and eat more fruits and vegetables, and they didn't lose weight. And it's because you still have to replace something. Like, if you're going to replace half your pasta, buttered pasta with like broccoli, that's going to work. Don't just add it on top of it.
And that's the other kind of bizarre thing about the conclusions, I think, is that, you know, one of the main things they were looking at, or one of the main reasons for their conclusion, seems to be that, hey, in the long term, we don't have really good evidence of weight loss. I mean, now I think we do when replacing sugar sweetened beverages, but just generally we don't have good data on long-term weight loss just by consuming more artificially sweetened beverages. But look at any food.
Yeah.
Literally. You can look at any food you want to and see if it leads to weight loss in the research we have, like, you know, 10, 15, 20 years down the line. Like, good luck.
Yeah.
You're just not.
Lentils.
And so does that mean we're not? Yeah, I love my lentils. But like, for real though, you'd be pretty limited in what you could recommend at that point.
Exactly. Well, I appreciate you coming on. It was awesome. We'll have to have you on. We have a lot of common interests in terms of lipids. I know you just, you're kind of a shill for plant-based diets. We can kind of talk about that sometime and the nuance there, because you're good at talking to nuance without being kind of dogmatic about it. So I appreciate your presence online. Where can people find you?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say I'm most active on Instagram, also on like Facebook, Twitter, TikTok. So I basically post the same stuff on all of them, except Twitter. I just get into conversations with people. But
yeah,
yeah, you can follow me at any of those places. Message me. I'm usually pretty good at getting back. And definitely thanks for the kind words. And I love the stuff you're putting out with the GLP-1 agonists as well. I've definitely given that to a lot of patients, or some of your content to a lot of patients who had concerns as well. And seems to be doing really well with it.
If you found this interesting, the WHO stuff, make sure you share this with somebody who, you know, wanted to understand why the WHO made those recommendations. You get a little bit more nuance. Make sure you follow Dr. Matt Nagra. And yeah, give us a good little review. Here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.